In a world of Democrats,
there will be time for them to make profits. Now's not that time.
And Republicans,
I've abandoned free market principles to save the free market system.
You need a voice of liberty. Look no further. You found it. Tom Woods. Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
Welcome, everybody. It's Tuesday, September 16th, 2014. And today we welcome back to the show Michael Humer, who is a professor of philosophy at the University of Colorado at Boulder. We talked to Professor Humer earlier this year about his book, The Problem of Political Authority, An Examination of the Right to Coerce and the Duty to Obey. So we're having him back today to continue that conversation. Today we're going to talk about still more arguments in favor of government, in particular, the key argument advanced by Thomas Hobbes. And then we're going to do something extremely unfashionable, and that is to look at some of the problems of democracy, problems that the vast majority of people do not even perceive, but which exist all the same. Mike Humer, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I'm very pleased to have you on a second time, because last time I was so happy with how our discussion came out that in a forthcoming book I have that's coming out next month, I want to give people a flavor of the show, so I chose about transcripts of about half a dozen episodes from this year that I thought were truly outstanding and that gave something of the texture of the show. Yours was one of them, and I want to have you on now to get to the second half of your book. And of course, the second half, like the first half, could indeed be the subject of many episodes. There's so much here. But just to recap, before we dive into the second half, give the audience again an idea of what you're trying to accomplish in the first half of this book, The Problem of Political Authority.
Well, the first half is designed to refute the idea of political authority. The idea of political authority, as I define it, is the idea that the state has a kind of special moral status, which explains why the state is entitled to coerce people, to force them to obey the state, in circumstances in which it would not be permissible for any other agent to coerce people. And this idea of authority is also supposed to explain why the citizens have an obligation to obey the state, even though they would not be obligated to obey anyone else who is making similar commands. And so in the first half of the book, I address theories that people have given for why the state has this authority, and basically just argue that none of the leading theories work, and thus that the correct conclusion is there is no authority, and the state should be subject to the same moral principles that we apply to all other agents.
Now, what is the consequence, the radical consequence, of applying the same moral standards to the state that we apply elsewhere?
Yeah, so basically it's you have to be a libertarian. So when you think about the controversial policies that libertarians advocate, they're all things that would be completely uncontroversial if we were talking about anyone other than the state. So, for example, consider social welfare programs whereby the government takes money from some people in order to use it to benefit the relatively poor. If we were talking about anyone other than the state, this would be considered completely impermissible. So if I'm running a charity, it's not okay for me to forcibly take money from contributors in order to help the poor, right? Even if it's a beneficial charity, even if I'm really helping the poor, it's not permissible for me to just force people to contribute to it, right? So that's one example, but you could take basically any other libertarian policy. So consider the drug war. If we were talking about someone other than the state, it would be considered completely impermissible for someone to decide that some substances are unhealthful and therefore that they're going to kidnap anyone who's using those substances and lock them in a cage for some period of years, right? If I decide to go to my neighbor and just take him captive at gunpoint and then lock him in a small cage because he's consuming some substance that I think is dangerous to his health, I would be a horrible criminal, right? And that's basically what the current drug policy is.
So what you're trying to do then in the second half of the book is to take people all the way to the conclusion of the argument, because at first you're striking down the kinds of claims that have been made on behalf of the state and which so many people have imbibed through the course of their education and in popular culture. We've imbibed some version of the social contract or whatever the excuse is, and you've dismantled all those arguments, but that leaves people standing there wondering, well, then what would we do in the absence of this institution? And then you're going on to say, well, this is how things might work, because the argument that I left us with last time was, what if somebody said to you, I agree with you that all these arguments for government are extremely flimsy, and they all rely on the idea that government is some entity that's entitled to behave in ways we would consider outrageous in any other situation. I get all that, but I'm afraid we can't live without it, right? That would be the thing that would still be in people's minds. And here's what you're going to try to take apart in the second half. So what I'd like to do, I'd actually like to go to chapter, I guess, 9, and start with the classic Hobbesian claim for why it is that we need government. Because I think in one form or another, whether people are outright Hobbesians or not, in one form or another, they do adopt that view, I think.
Yeah, so many people feel that if there were no government, then there'd be this just this war of everyone against everyone, you know, people constantly attacking each other to steal each other's stuff and murdering each other and so on. Hobbes's argument is, Hobbes starts from the assumption that people are completely selfish. The way that I characterize it, it may sound uncharitable, but I think it's actually correct, is Hobbes basically portrays human beings as sociopaths, right?
Yeah.
That is, in no moral sense, they only care about their own self-interest. And then he thinks that, given that, people are going to attack each other if they don't have a government. They'll attack each other partly to steal each other's stuff. You might attack other people just because you're afraid that they might attack you in the future, so you have to try to kill them first. And another thing is, he says that people will attack each other in order to force other people to express respect for you, right? So you just feel that some other person is not respecting you enough, so you decide to start a fight with him, right? So, according to Hobbes, the only way to stop this is for all of us to band together and agree to establish one person who will have total power over us, or one organization that will have total power. So they get all the guns, and then they will be able to stop us from fighting with each other. Of course, they will do this. This is the sovereign. The sovereign will stop us from fighting with each other, basically because he wants to be able to exploit us to get more money for himself. Right. And, you know, the fighting will not be good for business. So I think that's basically Hobbes' argument. The argument really doesn't make a lot of sense. To start with, there's the assumption that if you're completely selfish, then what you should do rationally is to attack other people whenever possible. This seems to me to be basically the opposite of the truth. If you're concerned with self-preservation, you should try to avoid fights with other people whenever possible. Bizarrely, Hobbes actually says that people are approximately equal in the state of nature, meaning equal in the sense of having about equal power to threaten each other.
Right.
If that's the case, then it's completely irrational to start fights with other people. If you start a fight with other people, that means that there's about a 50% chance every time you have a fight that you're going to die. Now, even if you think, like, maybe you're a little bit stronger than other people, or you think you're a little bit better with a gun, you know, even if there's only a 10% chance that you're going to die, it's still irrational to start fights with people, right? One of Hobbes' reasons why there would be fights between people is that you're afraid that somebody else might attack you, so you decide to attack them first. But if there are these people out there who are starting preemptive fights, who would they be starting preemptive fights with? Wouldn't it be with the people who have started the most fights in the past? Like, if you're afraid that somebody might attack you, wouldn't you be most afraid of the people who have previously attacked other people?
Sure.
And what that means is that if you go around attacking people, then other people are going to be afraid of you, and that means they're going to decide that they have to attack you first. Right? So it's a completely irrational strategy to start these, to start conflicts, right? Now, the other part of the theory that doesn't make any sense is the theory that once you establish this organization with total power over everyone, then they will be nice and respect everyone's rights and protect everyone from each other. No, why won't they just use their power to completely exploit everyone, right, and to kill anyone that they don't like? And sadly, this is not just a hypothetical, right? This is the sort of thing that actually happens when a government gets absolute power, right? As you see in cases like the Soviet Union or Communist China or Nazi Germany.
But what about people who say there does seem to be some plausibility to the Hobbesian argument? Because I can think of examples like the collapse of state X or state Y, and I could recall it being followed by disorder in the streets and people shooting at each other. And isn't that what it is that we're fighting against? I mean, I wonder if that's not a case of people live in the expectation that a new state will eventually be formed. And so it's hard for us to think outside that box, and so they begin, in effect, trying to place themselves as the new state.
Yeah, so, I mean, the thing that I was saying a minute ago is that it's irrational in the sense of it's not in your interest to start fights with other people. However, it might take a little time for people to figure that out.
Yeah.
So, like, they might not realize that the first day. But, you know, after you've been going around for a few months starting fights with other people and, you know, you've gotten your arm broken and you've gotten shot a couple of times, then you might start thinking, maybe I should stop doing this. Okay, but the real point is, okay, the anarchist view is not to just get rid of the state and then that's it. You know, it's not that nothing, replace the state with nothing, right? It's not that nobody should be protecting anyone's rights. The anarchist view is that the services that are provided by the state should be provided, but they should be provided by somebody else. Namely, they should be provided by businesses for profit.
You have here in the book a claim that when you're dealing with the question of violence, when you're dealing with the question of violence between human beings, it's a relevant consideration to bear in mind that violence between states is much more difficult to deter than violence between individuals. Now, what do you mean by that? How do you defend that statement?
Yeah, well, so typically if you start a violent conflict with somebody else, you yourself and the other person are personally at risk. So if I go fight with my neighbor, there's a pretty good chance that I'm going to be seriously physically injured or killed. On the other hand, if Obama decides to send more troops to Afghanistan, he doesn't have to worry that he's going to be personally injured or killed. When George W. Bush started the war in Iraq, he had no fear at all that he was going to get shot in the war, right? And so the people who are making the decisions when it comes to war between states are not personally at risk, so they don't really have the incentive to avoid the conflict that you would have if you're personally involved.
Right, okay. All right, so that's an incentive that also works. And then also, you have here some discussion of, again, it's not enough to just say, well, as long as there's no state, that solves your problems, or that there are no institutions that replace it or anything like that. But you also note that there are cultural values that can make a society with or without a state more liable to be violence or crime prone than otherwise.
That's right, yeah. I mean, so, you know, there is some research on this, that there are some societies in which there's less social trust. So just people in the society in general don't trust each other as much. And in those societies, if you do these prisoner's dilemma experiments, people are more likely to defect. And in other societies with more social trust, people will cooperate. They'll just be an assumed norm of cooperation. You know, I have a friend who recently came back from Africa and was telling me about his experiences there. One of the things he was saying was that it's a very communal sort of society, and in some ways that could be good, but in some ways harmful. So it makes it very difficult for somebody to build capital, because as soon as you acquire a little bit of money, you're expected to start giving it away to extended family members, right? And that's not even a matter of the government, right? That's just a matter of the customs,
right,
in that kind of culture. That could make a big difference to their economic progress, right?
And that's been one of the arguments that Peter Bauer has made, or used to make when he was alive, for many years that there are some factors that that have to be dealt with on a cultural level, that it's not enough to just send foreign aid to particular places. If the cultural preconditions don't exist, then there can be perverse results. Now, what you have here also, I think we can all see what happens in a totalitarian state. That's obvious to people. What's not so obvious is predation under democracy. Like, it's easy to see in an anarchic system, let's say you have a system, a condition in which somebody does get killed, and there is no government. There's only a private sector institution. We can all see somebody get killed, and the institution failed to prevent this. We can all see that. Yeah. But under democracy, I think people have absorbed the idea that we govern ourselves, we are the government, we are making the decisions. So the idea that there could be any predation is excluded by the very way people frame the argument of democracy.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a sense in which, in a democracy, the people are under control of the government. But it's a much weaker sense than the sense in which, in the capitalist economy, you affect the market. The way that you control the government is you have a vote which gives you a 1 in 10 million chance of affecting who is in office, right? But the problem is, for 1 in 10 million chance of affecting the outcome of an election, it's not worth doing anything, right? I mean, it's not worth taking any measures to make sure that your decision is correct. It's not worth spending any time doing research to find out who the best candidate is, to find out what their voting records are. It's not worth taking the time to try to eliminate your political biases.
Right.
It's not worth making any effort if you only have a 1 in 10 million chance of affecting things. Right?
Yeah, exactly. Compare this, if people are inclined to reject this idea, compare this to the amount of time and research you put into buying a car. You look into all the different models and all the features and what exactly you need, because you know that you will affect that outcome. Soon as you slap down that money, you will get that exact car, and you'll get it immediately, and you will enjoy the flow of benefits that come from it, or the flow of headaches that come from making a bad choice of car. I want to do a lightning round here. You've got a number of subheadings under predation under democracy. I want you to give me like no more than a 30-second summary of the problems with democracy as I tick them down one at a time. You ready? All right.
I'll try.
All right, here we go. All right. Well, this one shouldn't be too hard. The tyranny of the majority. I think people are aware of this.
Yeah, obvious problem is that the majority might just vote for something that is against the interest of the minority. For example, white people voting for laws that are prejudiced against black people. Right.
Okay, how about second one? The fate of non-voters.
Yeah, so there are various people who don't get a vote but are affected by the government's policies. There are children, there are criminals, and most importantly, there are foreigners who are affected by the government's foreign policy, by our trade policy. When we go to war, we could kill, you know, hundreds of thousands or even millions of foreigners, and they don't get a vote on that.
The news media, the sleeping watchdog, you say that it's not in the interest of the news media to keep close watch over the government. Really?
That's right, yeah. Well, see, for one thing, the audience doesn't know the facts, so they won't know whether the news media is doing a good job or not. The news media is trying to sell advertising time, so what they really need to do is make entertaining programs. It doesn't so much matter whether it's true or not. And if they criticize the government, there's a possibility that the government will retaliate. On a very simple, you know, relatively minor level, government officials will refuse to give interviews or give information to reporters who they suspect might be critical of the government.
All right, how about constitutional limits, right? We can put a constitution in effect, and that will limit the government to certain activities.
Yeah, so, I mean, you could just look empirically at how this has worked.
Right.
In my judgment, over 90%, probably 99% of all of the activities of the U.S. government are obviously unconstitutional. For anyone who doesn't realize that that's the case, you know, read the 9th and 10th Amendments, where the 10th Amendment says basically that anything that's not listed in the Constitution is something that the government cannot do, and virtually nothing that the government does currently is actually listed in the Constitution as something that they can do, right? The problem is that there's nobody to enforce the Constitution other than the government.
Yeah.
So it's like saying we're going to stop bank robbers by having the bank robbers police themselves, right? The bank robbers will just arrest themselves.
Well, but what about, and then you have a section here that might be relevant, what about citizen activism? Can't they keep an eye on what government is up to?
Yeah, they might, but, you know, again, you only have a 1 in 10 million chance of affecting the outcome of an election, so it doesn't really make sense for you to become informed about it, right? Now, you can maybe slightly increase your influence by writing to your congressman, right? But you're still, like, only one of whatever 500,000 people in the district or something. And there are just so many different issues, right? So a normal person just doesn't have time to stay informed on all the different political issues where politicians are voting, right?
Well, and of course, I do this every single day of my life. I have a show. I talk about all kinds of issues. And I'm sure I haven't covered the tiniest sliver of the things the government is up to. And this is from a guy who does it all the time, every single day. What about checks and balances, though? I learned in elementary school that checks and balances keep the government, I don't know, somehow on an even keel. It's not clear to me why checks and balances would keep government limited, by the way. There's no reason to think that. But what are they supposed to do, and don't they do it?
Yeah, the theory there is just really unclear. So the theory appears to be that the different branches of government would restrain each other to make sure that, you know, none of the other branches abuse their powers, but there is no explanation at all of why they would do that. Why can't each of the branches of government use its powers to interfere with the correct execution of the other branches, or why can't they collude with each other to expand the power of the government? No account was ever given of how these different branches of government would be in competition with each other rather than making common cause in extending the power of government at the expense of the liberties of the people.
And Jefferson actually said this in the mid-1820s. He said, but the three branches will just gang up on the public. Like, it seems to him likely that that would be the result, so the much-vaunted checks and balances were unlikely to have the results that people hoped for them. What about your section, the rewards of failure? How could government actually benefit from failing to solve the problems it purports to?
Yeah, I have a favorite example under this heading, which is the 9/11 terrorist attacks. Right after the 9/11 terrorist attacks, George W. Bush's approval rating went through the roof. In fact, I think it was the highest that anyone has ever had since they started doing those polls.
Yeah.
Now, imagine, you know, as an analogy, if you had a security company that you hired to protect your business.
And I see where this is going.
You just found out that, you know, your business was bombed during the night and, you know, they destroyed a bunch of property and stuff. And then somebody asks you, what do you think of the job that your security company is doing, right? What do you say? Best security company ever.
Exactly. That's right. With a fist pump. Yeah, I don't think so.
But for some reason, when the government fails, they actually get more resources and more power. This is partly because there's no competition. So, you know, as another example, if we have a crime wave, people are going to call for there to be more resources given to the police, more money and more power. But what that means is that it's actually in the interests of the police for there to be a crime wave. So that means that government agencies, like, it's in their interests for the problems that they're supposed to solve to get bigger, not for them to actually be solved.
And then finally, let's see, is there anything I've missed? Yeah, the miracle of aggregation. Talk about that for a minute, if you would.
Well, so there was a theory that some people have had in, I guess, economic literature, that democracy could possibly work even if the majority of people are totally uninformed. Because imagine that, so say you have 90% of the voters and they're totally uninformed, and so their votes are just completely random. But if 10% of the voters are well-informed and they vote for the best candidate, the result is going to be that the best candidate is going to win 55 to 45, because, you know, the ignorant voters will just split 50-50, and then the informed voters will all vote for the better candidate, right? The better candidate is still going to win.
Right.
Yeah, the only problem with this is when people don't know what the best candidate is or the best policy, they don't just pick randomly.
Right, right.
If only they did, then we'd be okay. But in fact, they are more likely to vote on the basis of biases. And there's actual literature. There's, you know, empirical evidence of some of the specific biases people have. So incumbents benefit from ignorance. Basically, if you don't know anything else, then you're more likely to just vote for the incumbent.
Okay.
Also, there's a slight bias in favor of Democrats. So if you don't know anything else, you're more likely to vote for the Democrat.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I know Brian Kaplan summarizes some of the literature on this in The Myth of the Rational Voter on the subject of the so-called miracle of aggregation. Turns out it's not a miracle because it doesn't exist.
Right, yeah. Yeah, so, you know, and this is part of why, well, actually incumbents in Congress almost always win. Their win rate is something like, you know, over 85%, I think. And so this means that if you're an incumbent, you can, if you're in Congress, you can kind of get away with almost anything, right? Other than a sex scandal, which will get you in the news, right?
Yeah, then you'll have to retire for 2 years and then you come back. But
right.
Yeah, it's, you know what interests me, though, is that you would think, given that people tend to be dissatisfied with things in general, they always wish they could be earning more income or whatever, and sometimes they'll blame the political system, rightly or wrongly, for their own personal situation, you would think that ignorance would lead them to go against the incumbent. Just an angry ignorance would lead them to just go down the line and vote for whoever is the challenger. It surprises me, and I don't even see the logic in why this would favor incumbents.
I'm not really sure. I think it's a common attitude that we need to get the bums out of Congress, but not my bum.
Yeah.
Which, you know, they want the people in the other districts to get rid of their congresspeople, not your own. I don't know, but I mean, you might think, well, the fact that this person won an election might mean that they're charismatic or just that they're connected, that they have a good campaign machine, that they have contributors who give them money. So, and the challenger, you know, will frequently not have these advantages. They will not have the connections. They won't have the campaign money.
Now, what I want to do, we're going to call it quits for today because I kept you about as long as I can get away with, but I guess I'm just going to have you on a third time. I wanted to cover these arguments because we've all heard the Hobbesian claim again and again, and we've all heard arguments for why democracy solves our problems, or at least solves them in a tolerable way, and I wanted to go through some of these. But then what we have to do, of course, is the key thing, which is, again, people thinking, well, I steal your TV, and the court that I want to go to says that it's okay to steal your TV because you're a wicked capitalist exploiter, and your
right.
court says that, no, I'm violating your property rights, and then how can we ever resolve it other than we have a duel in the middle of the street? So next time, if you'll consent to come on yet again, we'll get to that part. And
yep.
But in the meantime, I want to urge people, the book is The Problem of Political Authority, An Examination of the Right to Coerce and the Duty to Obey. And if you're worried that Mike Humer is a philosopher and therefore you can't understand a word he's saying, first of all, I hope our discussion today has disabused you of that false notion. But also, I can attest that this is an eminently readable, thoroughly enjoyable book. And as you're reading it, you're going to feel like this is a book that has seriously advanced our understanding, advanced the quality and caliber of our arguments, and it will certainly increase your own ability to improve your ability to spread these ideas when you are inevitably faced with naysayers and objections. So, Mike, I appreciate your time. We got to get people to get this book, The Problem of Political Authority. I'll do everything I can on my end, and then we'll get you back for, finally, the grand conclusion we've been building to all throughout 2014. Thanks again.
All right, thank you.
Okay, everybody, just a reminder that the work that has sapped all the life out of me and left me an empty shell is a good portion of the way finished. I'm talking, of course, about the Ron Paul Homeschool Program, ronpaulhomeschool.com. My course in Western Civilization, From the Ancient World to 1492, is up and ready to be purchased a la carte. So you don't have to join the whole Ron Paul program if you don't want to, as is my course Introduction to Government. And these cover topics that you're dying to know about, but you don't have the time to learn them. So I've basically taken 20 years worth of learning and stuffed them into these courses. Taken together, they're 270 video lessons. They're also audio, if you prefer that, plus recommended reading if you'd like to really go with it. These courses are for adults as well as for high school students. You are not going to feel talked down to if you take them. and you can painlessly fill in the gaps in your knowledge in a vast array of areas. Please do me a favor, because I've been working, killing myself on this. Just take a look at them. Just take a look at the topics covered. You can find them at TomWoodsHomeschool.com. And then once you've looked at them, if you think this is something you want, get them at SupportingListeners.com in one of the Tom Woods bags of goodies, okay? Those bags of goodies at SupportingListeners.com, you're not going to believe. You know, you help out PBS, they send you a crummy umbrella for a $250 donation. You get an umbrella. But look at the stuff you get for helping me out keep this show going at SupportingListeners.com. It's ridiculous. I mean, it is I've never seen anything like this. Like, you're getting more than you're giving. But that's just the kind of guy I am. So put a circle and a line through your PBS umbrella, and instead head over to SupportingListeners.com and look at the stuff I've got listed there for you guys right now. Make sure and check me out in New York City, October 11th at Liberty Fest. You can find out details at LF, that's for Liberty Fest, LFNYC.com. I'll be there on Saturday, October 11th. Then 2 weeks later, October 25th, I'll be in Boise, Idaho, and I'll have a couple more events to announce in the coming weeks. Thanks so much for listening. Make sure you're subscribed on iTunes or Stitcher, which you can easily do at TomWoodsRadio.com, so you can make sure and keep on getting your daily serving of Liberty Education. Thanks for listening, everybody.
The Tom Woods Show.